It is Tuesday, May 7th. Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Avi, welcome back.
It's great to be back, Cherry.
Yes, Avi was on vacation, y'all. Now, looking at him, you look like you are relaxed and refreshed. Yes.
Thank you so much. One of the things that I noticed when I got back, one of the first things I read was pretty stunning to me. It was a story in The Inquirer about how Pat's King of Steaks is going to start selling chicken cheese sticks.
I love chicken cheese sticks.
I do, too. I think people are far too doctrinaire about cheese sticks. I welcome the change. But when it took me back when I saw it. You know, I said, what Philadelphia am I returning to?
A new one. Chicken cheese sticks.
That's right.
One that I'm welcome. I feel very welcome in.
Absolutely. And breakfast sandwiches, by the way.
Ooh.
Which I'm really pumped about because I live just a couple blocks from there. And there are many days where I walk out of the house and go, well, I need to eat something. And now I can head on over to Pat's and get a breakfast sandwich.
Get yourself a breakfast sandwich and then a chicken cheese steak for lunch.
That's right.
Just have your whole two meals covered.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what's actually on the show today, Cherry? Well, a couple of stories that we're going to get to. The first in this segment is going to be about this proposed crackdown on the open-air drug market in Kensington, which seems to be funneling toward a major event tomorrow. We're going to talk about it with WHYY reporter Nicole Leonard later in this segment. And then for the back two-thirds of the show, we're going to talk with a name that you probably know, MSNBC host and chief correspondent Ali Velshi. He has a new book out today called Small Acts of Courage, and it's all about his family's cross-continental journey from India to Africa to Canada, and now here, he lives just outside Philadelphia, Ali Velshi does. Fascinating story. Really enjoyed the book. And it's crazy how his family's story is so swept up in the major currents of 20th century history. I mean, it really hits on so many things that have been the big things over the last 100 years.
It's so, and he gets to benefit from a lot of the things that his family went through.
Yes.
And it's also interesting to me because, you know, many times journalists don't tell their individual stories, their family histories like this. So I do wonder what it was like for him to sort of peel back the layers of his own history in that way. And if you have questions for Ali Velshi about his book, about politics, you know, open forum. You can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Let's jump into some headlines now, Cherry. I think I remember how to do this. And today you're going to start.
Yeah. More tension at Penn over the pro-Palestinian encampments on campus as the protest enters day 13. The university's interim president, J. Larry Jamison, issued a statement Monday saying that while the presence of that encampment makes the university less safe, disbanding it would only escalate tension. Avi, you probably were still seeing a lot of those headlines happening on other campuses when university officials tried to disband. It kind of got violent with students and protesters taking over buildings and things escalated. Well, Jamison claims Penn will take a measured approach as there is fear that protesters want a confrontation and possible violence. He has said the encampments are in violation of campus policies and that it's interrupting campus operations and events. University officials are trying to figure out whether or not they want to negotiate with the demonstrators or if they want to take a stronger stance. And of course, city officials, politicians are all saying de-escalate, don't let things go awry. And so they're trying to find this balance and not go the way of Columbia and some other universities that had tensions sort of flare up.
There was a negotiated resolution at Rutgers, for instance.
But
that created its own backlash.
It did.
Now there's potentially investigations into how Rutgers handled that because Rutgers is a state university and so state lawmakers are involved. Penn, a slightly different situation. But like you said, it's in the middle of a major American city.
Yeah.
This is not a campus island onto itself. And so there are so many constituencies involved. Commencement, I believe, is May 20th. It's 13 days away. So that is something that's sort of a date to mark in your mind as well as we wait to see how this is
are happening.
Yep.
So,
yep.
I mean, a lot is going on campus. And there is a stalemate, by the way. No negotiations have been happening. They're at a stalemate and we'll see what happens.
Moving to our next story now, Cherry. I've never flown in a private jet, I'll be honest. Small planes make me very, very nervous. Apparently, for Governor Josh Shapiro, who has been using the state's private plane, that's sort of an oxymoron, has been using the state's private plane seemingly far more than his predecessors, according to a really nice investigative piece mm-hmm. by Stephen Caruso of Spotlight PA. They looked at public records to determine how much the state private plane is being used. Maybe you didn't even know.
Pennsylvania has a private plane. Learn something new.
And Shapiro's using it quite a bit. 150 hours of flight time in 2023. When Tom Wolf was governor, the most he ever used it in a year was 77 hours of flight time. So that's like about double, mm-hmm. right, of Wolf's highest year. So Shapiro's using it a lot. It's a little hard to tell exactly what he's using it for because of the nature of the disclosure laws, but it seems to be a mix of public announcements, private meetings with officials across the country, and even a Philadelphia Phillies playoff game.
Interesting. But does this mean mm-hmm. that the governor just likes to be in more places?
Out and about.
He has repeatedly said he hates
pressing the flesh,
sitting behind
hands,
a desk in Harrisburg, that he wants to be on the ground. And you remember when 95 had that incident? I mean, he was at the press conferences. Mm-hmm. So he's probably zigzagging back and forth from Harrisburg. I mean, he likes to be
retail,
you know,
politics.
He even visited Punxsutawney Phil. You know what I mean? The first governor to have done that in like more than a decade. So like he likes to press the flesh, as you said.
That's important, yes.
Yeah.
Glad he got to meet the groundhog.
But people are criticizing it because it is expensive.
But how can you criticize it, Cherry, when he got to meet the groundhog? I mean, that's so important. That's official state business.
Yeah.
well, I came back a little spicy, apparently.
You did.
So, yeah, I'll let the story speak for itself. Whether you think it's justified or not, you can read the story.
It's definitely interesting whether or not all those visits were for a public purpose, which mm-hmm. is what the plan is for. So our final story in the roundup here, the Philadelphia NAACP, Avi, announced today that it is throwing its support behind the new Sixers arena.
Hmm.
The Philadelphia chapter signed a memorandum of understanding that signals their support. They're going to be joining the African-American Chamber of Commerce in our region, the Black clergy, several African-American community leaders, all supporting the Sixers arena, as well as the Building Trades Union. The Philadelphia NAACP chapter president, Kathy Hicks, she says they see this as a win for the Black community when it comes to jobs. She also thinks it will change the narrative of the city. The Sixers have agreed to contract with Black-owned contractors to build the arena. They've also promised to reserve about 40% of concessions for Black-owned businesses and to spend about $2 million developing those Black-owned businesses so that they can work at the Sixers arena. And so that is the announcement. And they brought out the cheerleaders. They had a drum line with all the kids, you know.
They were literally drumming up support.
The String Theory Schools on Vine Street. So this is just, you know, the season is over, but eyes still on the Sixers place.
The real battle begins. Mm-hmm. But this fault line has been developing for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about this conversation about whether to build an arena or not in the Market East neighborhood, lots of the major players in the Black community have lined up behind this initiative.
Have.
Some might point out that that is a significant source, a significant part of the base mm-hmm. of the political base of the current mayor, mm-hmm. right? So does that matter? We don't know. But that this is something that's been developing for a while. And so the NAACP's support seems in many ways anticipated and expected.
Yeah. Yeah, and they have said that, look, they represent all people, not just the African-American mm-hmm. community. They've argued that this will be good for Chinatown. Of course, the Chinatown community disagrees strongly.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of other constituencies that are against this. But this is yet another chip on the side of
the Sixers arena. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia Mayor Sherelle Parker, we just mentioned her. She has vowed to shut down Kensington's open-air drug market. And this week, her administration is poised to take a major step in that direction, clearing out an encampment around Kensington and Allegheny Avenues, right in the heart of this beleaguered neighborhood.
There's already been a larger police presence in Kensington in the last few months, and some people have complained of increased police harassment. Of course, many other Kensington residents are welcoming Parker's efforts to clean up the neighborhood. But the question is, will this crackdown on the drug market and encampment work? And at what cost? WHYY health and science reporter Nicole Leonard joins us to talk about it all. Nicole, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
I think the obvious first question, Nicole, is how did we get here? Like what has the administration already been doing, and why has it led up to whatever is going to happen tomorrow?
Yeah. I mean, well, if you remember when Parker was running on her ticket, she made a big deal about talking about revitalizing Kensington. And, you know, to go a little bit more back into history, this is an area of the city that has seen divestment for many decades, right? Before the open air drug market, before the opioid crisis really sort of ran with it, this neighborhood has become impoverished for a very long time. And so that kind of gave way to what Josh Shapiro actually called, when he was attorney general, a $1 billion drug trade market in the heart of Kensington. And it has, over the years, some strategies from previous administrations have tried to tackle the problem, tried to address safety concerns, tried to get people into more treatment. And so over the years, we've kind of seen these things not really work.
Yeah, it the situation, never take root. Yeah.
Right. The situation has sort of stayed the same. And so Parker has really come in and made it her one of her top priorities to end the open air drug market.
And so let's dig into Parker's tactics. What has this administration done since they took power?
Yeah, so they've been leaning a little bit more into police presence, right? More so than other city administrations who've really, and including the Philadelphia District Attorney, they haven't been prosecuting every single drug crime, every single law on the books, because it's just so prevalent in this neighborhood. You'd have many people who are in jail facing crimes, who are also have substance use issues and who need help with other things. Parker has definitely leaned into the more police presence. She's utilizing her relationship with the police department and other departments to come up with a strategy to clear out sections of Kensington when there is not only drug use open air on the streets, but there's a large homeless population, right? So those two things go hand in hand, particularly in this area. And her plan really relies on police presence, clearing out the area first, stabilizing the area, so essentially keeping the area clear of encampments going forward, and then eventually handing back the reins, you could say, to the more local community once things, once they can, I guess, ensure that people will not return, that drugs will not return. That is the broader plan.
That's the theory. So tomorrow, they're going to go into the heart of the neighborhood and clear out one of these encampments. What does that actually mean? Where do the people go?
Yeah.
To the extent that we know at this point.
That's a good question. Yeah. Yes. And what tomorrow's date is, this has been leading up for about a month, right? So there have been notices that have been posted around the city saying on May 8th, you are no longer going to be able to erect tents and encampments and live on the street here and practice drug laws. The city is going to come in. They've been trying to get over the past couple weeks people into shelters and treatment beds ahead of time. But tomorrow is going to be the first official day where it is essentially, laws are going to be enforced more strictly. They are going, no loitering, right? Because that's technically a law on the books that really hasn't been enforced too much. After tomorrow, though, streets are going to be closed down. Police presence are going to go in from about, 8 in the morning to the later afternoon hours. And they are going to slowly tell people that they need to dismantle whatever they have on the street and they need to leave. And supposedly the organization says they will be offering services either if people need treatment beds. They've opened additional beds in the Fairmount section at an already city operated shelter for people who may want to choose that. Other services might be offered, like housing or addiction treatment beds, but those are already sometimes complicated to get people into.
Got to ask you, so what's going to happen? To any ideas of what's going to happen to someone who doesn't want to go to in treatment and they just want to keep living their life the way that they've been living their life, what is going to happen to them?
Well, from what we know, that if they are there and they choose to not leave, which is the point of the whole encampment tomorrow, and if they are lingering, loitering, have any certain drug paraphernalia on them or drugs, because this we're talking about an open air drug market, so people have had substances on them and using, the idea is that they will eventually be arrested. And at that point, we don't quite know yet,
And the district attorney has to do something.
Yes, the district attorney gets involved. And there are a lot of steps between that and jail time. We don't know if people will be offered different pathways instead of jail and things like that. So that is more questions are, unanswered about that.
Before we let you go, part of the press release that came out yesterday about this mentioned that the media would not be allowed to cover it. Any idea where that's coming from? That I think that struck everybody as unusual and raised some red flags.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely raised some red flags. I think the idea is that we are not, it said the media is not encouraged to cover this, mm-hmm. but if they do, they'll be, you know, sectioned off into a certain area. I mean, my opinion as a reporter our job is to bear witness for the entire city, to make sure that the city is doing what it says it's going to do mm-hmm. and offer the services it says it's going to offer. People are really concerned. They want to see, you know, people who support Parker's plan want to see this effectively, taken, and then people who are worried, who are on the street, people, harm reduction workers, people who are living there, also want to know that they will be handled with care and consideration during this process.
So I take it that you're going to go down there. You're going to do your job as a journalist, and you're going to bear witness.
Yes, that's exactly what I'll do. I'll be there and not get in the way, but definitely be there to see what's going on.
Yeah.
And we wish you luck.
Mm-hmm.
And we know how important that job is. Not to play favorites here, but thank you. WHYY's Nicole Leonard telling us everything about what we think is going to happen tomorrow in Kensington. Nicole, thanks for the time on Studio 2.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And coming up next, MSNBC host Ali Velshi has a new memoir about his family's history. It's called Small Acts of Courage, and he's here in studio with us next. We're looking forward to
that. And get your questions in for Ali Velshi. Studio2@WHYY.org. You can also give us a call, 888-477-9499. We would love to hear from you. It's going to be a great conversation.
For sure.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Our next guest lives just outside Philadelphia, but to understand how Ali Velshi got here, you need to hear a story that spans centuries and continents. It starts in a small Indian village with stops in South Africa, Kenya, South Africa again, Kenya again, and Canada. It is a family journey shaped by colonization, persecution, and a relentless pursuit of something better. And it is a thoroughly modern tale, one made possible by our increasingly mobile and connected world.
It's all laid out in a new book called Small Acts of Courage, A Legacy of Endurance and the Fight for Democracy. You likely know author Ali Velshi from the TV and radio airwaves. Velshi is the host of Velshi on MSNBC and a weekly economics contributor to NPR's Here and Now. Ali Velshi, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much. It is great to be here.
And if you have a question for Ali Velshi, give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email us, studio2@whyy.org.
And so, Ali, you start your book with what I call your woke moment.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The moment you realize what it truly means to be a citizen of the United States, something you admit that you had taken for granted.
Yep.
I want you to explain this woke moment to everybody.
Yeah, it was the moment. It was Minneapolis. It was right after George Floyd had been murdered, and there were protests in the street. And it was the Saturday night after he'd been murdered on a Monday night. It was a peaceful protest, really peaceful. People were singing songs and things like that. And all of a sudden, the police and the National Guard, the state police, the Minneapolis police all converged in front of us and started firing rubber bullets and gas canisters and flashbangs into the crowd, unarmed crowd doing nothing. And most people scattered. So at that point, we were closer to the police, and I could tell they were shooting toward us. And I had a security officer with me who was a former NYPD police officer, newly retired. And he's grabbing me. He said, "They're shooting at us. They're shooting at us." He was incredulous. And finally, one hit me. I got hit by a rubber bullet in just below my knee. And what it made me understand is that I'm now in a fight that my parents were in for democracy and my grandfather was in the fight against apartheid. And, you know, this when things are not equal, you have a role. You're in the arena and you have to fix it. So the woke moment for me was that citizenship is not a series of rights that entitles you to stuff. It is. But in fact, it's also a series of responsibilities. And what that did that day is it brought me into the understanding that this is wrong and I have to be part of the solution.
And so then you start looking into your own family's journey, and it is an epic journey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's start with your great-great-grandfather, who's doing actually pretty well, relatively, in this northwestern part of India, right?
Right.
So take us there and tell us about your great-great-grandfather.
So they were merchants. They lived in a sort of a center where people who would bring their farming, they'd buy their farming stuff, or they'd bring their goods for trade. But India in the 19th century had a lot of drought. Now, that's just a climate matter, but the India of old, before it was colonized, was a wealthy country. It was a quarter almost of the world's GDP. And by the time the British left in 1948, it was 2%. Mm. So that's what colonialism does.
Drained all the resources.
They drained it all. Yeah. So now by the mid-1800s, when things are bad, it's not like things being bad in a normally functioning economy. You're getting wiped out. So my great-grandfather leaves for Africa to say, look, the family's not doing so well. We're now in some debt. Let me go. The roads are apparently paved with gold in South Africa, so let me go and try and make a new life. Now, look, they didn't have the information we have right now. They walked into – it wasn't apartheid. It wasn't going to become apartheid until 1947, but it was a thoroughly racist society. You just couldn't decide whether it was the British who were being racist towards you or the Afrikaners,
the
Dutch descendants who were going to be racist. So they walk into this place. I've always heard stories about how they were business people. Mm-hmm. There was no business. They had hand carts. They had push carts like a wheelbarrow, basically. And then one would fill it with vegetables and one would fill it with dry goods and they'd go and sell it. And over the years, they tried to make a life for themselves the way every migrant to America does, right? They make a little bit of money and they send a lot of it back home to try. And he did that. He settled all the debts back home. But now they're in this society where they're starting to prosper in South Africa, but they don't have equal rights.
Can we rewind a little bit before we get there? So it's your great-grandfather that and his brother who decide to leave.
Yeah.
And there's it's called small acts of courage, but there's one very big act of courage.
Yes.
that your great-grandfather,
yes.
It's a literal leap.
Yeah.
When you tell that story about your great-grandfather, can you also wrap in why they saw South Africa as a potentially better opportunity for them?
Remember where the boats went, right? It was this was the normal course of things. People were not going from India to America or Europe, generally speaking. There were a few exceptions. But the trade routes, if you're on the east side of India, you went to Hong Kong or Malaysia. If you're on the west side of India, you went to Africa.
Yep.
Durban and places in South Africa were the first port of call. And people had gone over and they'd written letters. And it was prosperous because you could earn enough money to sustain yourself in South Africa and still send some money home, which is still today the reason people migrate. Yep. So my great-grandfather's on the bow of the ship, and it's pulling into the port in South Africa, but the Boer War had just happened, and if he shows up as a British citizen, not a British citizen, but a British subject of India, the Boers may not allow him to get in. So he wanted to go in via land through Portuguese East Africa. Just thought it'd be easier to do that. But he had to he couldn't get there. That's not where the boat was going.
Mm-hmm.
So he jumps off the boat into shark-infested waters and swims to shore. And then goes through the jungle on land for about, what looks like about 60 miles or something of that nature.
Wow.
So that was a little bit bigger act of courage than most. But fundamentally, it was all these little things. And it's so relevant to our day because people still do this, right?
Yeah.
These journeys to go somewhere else, to the unknown. Unfortunately, a lot of my coverage takes me to these places where people go in, they don't speak the language, the credit card doesn't work. These days, the SIM card doesn't work in another country. And they're trying – they envision a better life for their children. But how to get there is very hard.
And it was fascinating because your family, your great-grandfather sort of settles in South Africa, builds up a business that is doing fairly well, makes friends with Gandhi, which is a pretty cool story, and sort of has these little acts, sort of takes on
it.
And you mentioned that he was not a very political man.
Correct.
but had little acts of resistance. Talk about South Africa at the time of your great-grandfather and these little acts of resistance.
So let's go to 1910. Gandhi's been in South Africa for almost 15 years now. And he feels that as he was fighting for rights for the Indians, you know, who were sort of in between the whites and the blacks and another group that they called colored, who were mixed white and race. Everybody had, South Africa was very organized in terms of its race. It knew what everybody was. So Gandhi was trying to get the Indians to fight for more rights. And he felt that they weren't motivated enough. I don't know if I want to use the word courage, but they were doing well in business. Why rock the boat?
Yeah.
Right? So Gandhi and my great-grandfather, the only thing they had in common, they're both Gujaratis. They spoke the same language and they shared an accountant. So they became friends. Gandhi lived in Johannesburg. My great-grandfather lived in Pretoria. Pretoria is where the government was. Gandhi had to come and meet with the government very often in negotiations. And so my great-grandfather had what was called a dray. It was a horse-drawn carriage, a cart, really, for goods. But Gandhi would use that to get around. So they didn't talk much politics. But one day they're sitting around and Gandhi says, I need more discipline. So I'm going to start a commune where we're going to grow all our own food. It's going to be self-sustaining. It's not going to be hot water. There's not going to be creature comforts. Can I take your son, who is now what would become my grandfather, who's 7 years old, and make him my youngest student? So my great-grandfather says, that's weird. He's a businessman. Why does he want to get involved with this radical? I mean, he likes Gandhi, but they're not doing these political things together. So he says, I think he's trying to get out of it. He says, well, we're Muslims and you're Hindu. Uh-huh. How's he going to learn his religion? He's 7 years old. Gandhi says, I will learn your religion and teach it to him, which he did. Gandhi read the Quran. Gandhi read all the religions, all the major monotheistic religions, and Hinduism, which is not monotheistic. So that was part of his pluralism. He read other people's faiths to understand them, and he taught it. So my grandfather learned his Islam from a Hindu man, grew up on this farm. You had two blankets. You slept on the ground. You put one blanket underneath you and one blanket above you, no hot water. You made all your food, low calorie intake. The point was to be thrown into jail. The point was preparing these people, toughening them up to say, you cannot ask for better things in life if you are not prepared to give up a little bit of something.
Yeah.
Wow. Who knows what that something will be? And through my grandfather's life, it influenced him. He did things. He took over the family businesses, but all the while he was doing the little things to fight apartheid that he could, giving food to those who needed it. He employed people who couldn't get jobs because they'd been in jail. Now, in South Africa, if you were black, you kind of were in jail at some point or other. It's the system,
for no
right?
reason. Yeah,
well, and it was very much like the American South, like in Alabama. They jailed you because the fine was either jail time or getting on what was a chain gang. Mm-hmm. So it was labor. They'd put them on the farms. So my grandfather and then my father would go to court on a Monday morning to bail everybody out because nobody had the money to be bailed out. So they did this for years and agitated the government. They learned ways in which they could fight apartheid in their small ways.
And they paid for it because their business, which they had built into quite an operation, was basically steamrolled and destroyed by the apartheid government. But before we get there, just something you said a moment ago reminded me of something that popped up over and over and over again in your family story. Gandhi is Hindu. Your family is Muslim.
Yep.
And yet when they're in a new land, some of the differences that might have divided them in India get flattened. Their identities get reshaped. And that's happened to your family over and over and over again. It's sort of like who you're in community with changes based on your context. And that's happening to people all over the globe right now.
That's right. And it's true. I mean, it's not unreal. It's just that where you're a Muslim in the context of other people being Hindus, that's important. Where you're Indian in the context of other people being not Indian, that becomes important. Yeah. Where you're not white in the context of other people being white, suddenly you find yourself giving somebody a nod on the street because, you know, there's some kinship there. And I think intersectionality is now about so many types of kinship that you can have. You might just feel it. And I think in this sort of fraught, troubled world, we're all seeking that kinship.
Yeah.
We're not necessarily looking to be just one type of our own. We're saying, what are we sharing? What am I seeing about you? Because there's some pain in the world right now. But part of the point of this book is that through small acts of courage, we can overcome all of this stuff. Because I work in a world, I'm just in the news and mostly the bad parts of it every day. Mm-hmm. It can be overwhelming.
Yeah.
Right. And apartheid must have been overwhelming to my grandfather and my father and my sister. But they decided to say there are some things within our purview for which we have agency, for which we can take responsibility and we can change. See, I was privileged. I was not born somewhere where the color of my skin affected me negatively. So I just thought vote, you know, citizenship is that thing that gives you a right to vote. And maybe do jury duty. I did not realize that we, when it is not fair for all of us. And the example, again, back to South Africa, is for the 5% of the population who voted, they had a great democracy. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic democracy. That's the way of the world. There are some very unfair democracies out there. There are a lot of democracies that have the vote that don't matter, that don't count. Iran has elections. Russia has elections. India is in the middle of an election right now. It'll be the biggest one in the history of the world. But it's going more autocratic. Hungary is becoming more autocratic. Turkey is becoming more autocratic. These are all democracies. So our fight, and when we look at our democracy and we say, well, what's really at risk? Lots of things are at risk. Voting rights, we all know, is at risk. Reproductive rights are at risk. So there's a perfect example. I am not suffering by virtue of limited reproductive rights today. But we're all not free because somebody in this country is suffering from not having reproductive rights. So these are the lessons that I learned on the first pages of that book in Minneapolis when I got shot. I realized we're not all free. Yeah. And until we are, the fight is still on.
I got to ask you, because in your book you write that you're not Indian, but of the Indian diaspora.
Right.
Like sort of, this was sort of like a journey of you reconnecting
yes.
with this far off land that was in your family. You knew
yes,
that's where
yes.
we're from, but you kind of had this distance. What was that like, sort of reconnecting with your roots in this way?
Well, as some great documentary makers and filmmakers have learned these days, food is the best way to connect mm-hmm. everybody. So in my family, my grandmother spoke Gujarati. She wore a sari every day of her life, and she cooked Indian food. So that was my main connection. In fact, she wanted to go to Indian movies from time to time. I couldn't understand the language, but they had a good snack bar. So I that's how I knew I was that thing, and I never wanted my parents to give me leftovers for lunch because everybody else had ham and cheese sandwiches. Because Muslims, we certainly weren't having ham and cheese sandwiches.
Yeah.
But I'm taking like leftover curry and things like that. It's a different world now. I grew into it, and I grew to understand that I can identify with all of my backgrounds. I am Indian. I am South African. I am Kenyan. I am Canadian. I'm American. I'm a citizen of the world. As I say on my Twitter bio, I'm actually a Kenyan-born Muslim, and Barack Obama was never in the room. I'm okay with all of it now, and I love that today kids who struggled with it that like I did are okay with their long ethnic-sounding names, with the food that they bring that they had for dinner last night. I struggled with it when I was a kid. I lived in a very, very white place. They were very kind. Everybody's very kind. But I needed very badly to fit in. And now I live in a world where you don't have to think about it that way.
And you're talking about where you were raised in Canada. But there is one more pit stop on this journey, which is mm-hmm. basically because of persecution, your family has to flee South Africa. And when I say flee, I mean it's like sneaking around
yeah.
border guards
yeah.
and stuff. And they end up in Kenya. We have to go to break in about 90 seconds, but can you explain why South Africa to Kenya? Because I think people might understand the South Africa part.
Right.
Yeah, it wasn't going well there. But why Kenya?
It was close. It was known. My dad had two sisters who had married two people from Kenya, and this was all part of the whole things are not going very well for us, so let's start to establish roots elsewhere. So they were familiar with it. It was a British colony, as had India been. So there was some sense of it. There was a large Indian community. The Indian diaspora went all over Africa.
Yeah.
So Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Mozambique, what was then Portuguese East Africa, South Africa. So there was some ability to go there. And Kenya was on the cusp of becoming a new nation.
Yep.
It was about to become independent. My parents would never voted. You know, it wasn't a completely fair and society lacking in racism, but there weren't rules about who could walk on the street at a certain hour. There was the sort of racism that exists in a society that has racism, and that would take a long time for that to end in Kenya. But it was a free society that was about to become substantially freer. So they went there, and my sister spent 10 years there. I mean, she grew up. She spent her formative years there.
A lot of hope, and then in some ways the hopes are dashed, and
That's right.
Probably have to get to that after a break. But let me reintroduce our guests. We are speaking with Ali Velshi, MSNBC host, and the author of a book out today called Small Acts of Courage, A Legacy of Endurance and the Fight for Democracy. It is all about his family's
yes.
epic continent-spanning journey that eventually landed him in Canada and then the United States outside Philadelphia.
And, Fred, if you have questions for Ali Velshi, give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email us at studio2@whyy.org. We'll be back with more Ali Velshi. Stick with us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. And we are back now with MSNBC host Ali Velshi. He has a new memoir out today called Small Acts of Courage, A Legacy of Endurance and the Fight for Democracy. And it's all about his family's journey from India to South Africa to Kenya, eventually Canada, all fleeing different types of persecution. And it's also about how that history has shaped him. Velshi now lives outside of Philadelphia.
And if you have questions or comments for Ali Velshi about his family, about the state of politics today, or threats to democracy, you can call us, get those calls in. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
So we were talking before the break about your family moving from South Africa to Kenya, seeking this freer life. And this is the part of the story that I think as an American you have the least frame of reference for, like why it did not go well for them in Kenya. Can you explain what happened in Kenya and why they ultimately decided to go to a place they thought was more welcoming, Canada?
So part of the colonial slash racist experiment was that in places that were controlled by colonial powers, they really made sure that people of different races did not unite because the numbers were too great, right? Mm. So you needed the Indians to be not in the same place as the indigenous black population. Now, while under colonialism, the people really reaping the rewards were probably companies and farms and, you know, institutions back in England. When you are, if you're a African born black person in Kenya and you go into the city to trade your goods or whatever the case is, you're not seeing the British Empire.
Yeah.
You're seeing the Indian shopkeeper. You're dealing with your Indian accountant. You're dealing with the Indian lawyer. You're seeing everybody who is enjoying a station above yours be the same. Now, the Indians in some cases had common cause with the blacks in Kenya in Tanzania and Uganda, but in some cases they didn't. In some cases they liked being a little bit higher up there. They liked the clubs. They weren't the same clubs that the white people could go to, but they were clubs nonetheless. Yeah. They liked the idea of feeling closer to the whites than the blacks. And when independence came to these countries, indigenous people rightfully thought, we have been abused for a really long time. We would like to run this country ourselves without your help and without your input. And not everybody felt that way, but there were these nationalist movements that were going that way. And Kenya was not the worst of it. Uganda was the worst.
Idi Amin is probably the worst.
But that was happening at the time. People were escaping Idi Amin's, and like people left with what they could carry. Their businesses were taken. Their wealth was taken. They literally left Uganda. And though they were British subjects, nobody got a British passport.
Yeah.
They learned that the number on their passport was actually numbered such that that meant you weren't really a British citizen. So Britain wouldn't take them. They're stateless now because they don't have a place in Uganda. So these people are scurrying around the world trying to find places to go. And my father was involved in helping some of them, both in Kenya and then ultimately in Canada. But the writing felt like it was on the wall for them. Now, in fairness to Kenya, the country of my birth, it never went that way in Kenya. They feared it would, and there was behavior that suggested it was going that way, and they didn't do a ton to make the Indians feel particularly protected at the time, but it did not go that way. But at the time, my parents were so hungry for full participation in democracy, and what they saw is for the next little while at least, they were not going to get that in Kenya, which is why they ultimately went to Canada.
And in Canada, your family was welcomed.
Yes.
Your father was able to build a life and break barriers.
Yes.
There.
And he wanted to from day one. I mean, they joined all, there were three political parties. They joined them all. Like, they didn't join them, but they went to all of their events. You know, they really wanted to understand it. They went with no preconceived notions as to what their politics should be because they didn't even know what, like, Imagine being able to make a choice. Imagine being able to choose whose political party you join, who you run for. So they do this for several years. 10 years into being in Canada, my father decides, I'm running for office.
Mm-hmm.
So he gathers a bunch of people in the living room, a small, small house. It was a 1,200 square foot house. We're in the living room. I'm sitting on the floor. And there's, you know, all the sort of smart, influential people in society we knew. We were, you know, young immigrants, so what did we know? And everybody said, this is a bit crazy. And he said, I'm going to do it. So he runs for office. He runs to become a provincial member of the legislature. And that's a sort of a key story in the book about the fact that I was 11 years old, and this is the most exciting thing that ever happened to me. And then, I don't know, do I tell everybody what happens on election night, 1987?
Yeah, I guess you got to read the book.
Read the book, yeah.
Okay, we won't spoil it. Let me read an email real quick. From Pia, who says, Allie, welcome to Philly.
In our house,
you're known as the hardest working man in television.
So many projects. Now I know why that is.
Thanks for sharing your family's story, and thank you for reporting from Ukraine and so many points in between. So that's just a note of thanks from Pia. But you talked about your family making a choice. Canada also makes a choice.
Yes.
Under the leadership of a couple prime ministers, but primarily Pierre Trudeau.
Yep.
Basically says, we are going to be a multicultural, pluralistic society. We are going to welcome immigrants in part because our country and our economy is stagnating here.
Yes.
And you have a lot of kind things to say about Canada mm-hmm. in this book. You seem to think it's working in Canada, this idea of intentionally building a multicultural society.
I was at an event less than a couple of weeks ago in Toronto, and it was a fundraiser for the Toronto Public Library. And the beneficiary of the fundraiser was newcomers to Toronto. What services can the library offer them, right? Financial counseling, language training, housing support. This is how Canada thinks about immigration. And it's across the board because every Canadian of my age remembers what Toronto looked like in early 1970s and realized it was a lovely yet podunk provincial place mm-hmm. where they zipped up the sidewalks at 6 o'clock and for love or money you couldn't buy something on a Sunday.
Yeah.
It is now a vibrant, amazing place on every level. It is the largest diaspora of most cultures outside of their own countries. Ukrainians are a perfect example. There are more Ukrainians there than there are anywhere else. Mm. But this is a place in the late 1960s. Pierre Trudeau and those who followed him said, we are not going to be able to punch above our weight if we don't, you know, the immigrants want to go to America. They want to go to the United Kingdom. How do we make this a place? So they decided it would be deliberately pluralistic. They would call you in and they would say, if you need to learn your language, you want to perpetuate that, we'll teach it after school on the government's dime. With the guess that if you come in and feel welcome in this country, you will still keep your culture and your names and your food and your language, and then you will also adopt the things that are common to Canadians, like hockey and Tim Hortons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's actually what happened. So we have the same problems in Canada. We've got housing shortages because lots of people come to the big cities. Every major city in the world has had a housing shortage for the last 100 years. That's an infrastructure issue. That's not an immigrant issue. We know the statistics are the same in Canada as they are in the United States. Immigrants do not commit more crimes than native-born people do in these countries. This is just a myth. They don't bring wages down. They do the work that we're not doing. They keep us going. They are our essential workers. I mean, this is all – the statistics back all of this up. And Canada realized this as an imperative a long time ago. America sort of did, but it doesn't articulate it.
In the same way. Yeah.
So we think of – we treat – you know, it's under Homeland Security immigration falls under in America, which I just think the framing is just all wrong. So you're treating it as a security issue.
Yeah. And Ali, I want to kind of zoom out because we only have about 6 more minutes in our interview. But you have a very unique view of the world and you're a journalist, right? And one of the things you talk about is how you were kind of living this life, you know, enjoying the privileges mm-hmm. of life. And then it was your wife, Lori, who challenged you. She said you could do more than what you were doing. And she pushed you to become better and become different. Sort of talk about how your life has changed since you started looking at the world through a very critical lens, using your platform in a very different way.
It's a 180. I mean, it's a different life.
And tell people the before and after.
I was a successful journalist who was going to follow a path, generally speaking, as a business journalist, I was going to follow a path that would be more successful each year. It would all work out, and I would interview CEOs about which of their favorite stores, you know, which of the stores they opened this year was their favorite. I would enjoy the fruits of being sort of well known and well compensated. But I wasn't looking at journalism through the perspective, and I write about this in the book, of Webb Walker, the guy who is, you know, shown in the movie Gandhi, yeah, where I am bearing witness. I'm there to bear witness because my viewers cannot see what it is I see. They do not have access to the places I go, like Ukraine or wherever it is I go. And I was not using that bearing witness to hold power to account. And if you're not doing those two things, you're just wasting people's time.
Yeah.
Right? Now you're just calling balls and strikes. And that's what I realized. And I don't fault those who do it otherwise, and I don't fault myself for doing it. I just didn't realize there was a more important calling to being a journalist. There was an ability to actually use my voice to make things better. And that's what I leaned into, and that has really changed me. Now, circumstances have helped because mm-hmm. this is a world that needs accountability.
And I like this because, well, where do you draw the line? I mean, there's activism because
yes.
you do stuff,
yeah.
you know, you talk about book bans, you talk
yeah.
about this fight for democracy.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's this distrust with media.
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line?
And I get it. I yeah. get the mistrust. And I will say this. I am an activist for democracy in the same way that I'm an activist against people getting murdered. I'm an activist against hurricanes wrecking people's lives. I'm an activist against kids dying in school shootings. That doesn't actually make me an activist about particular gun policies. It just means I understand this is wrong and this can't be wrong, and it's my job to draw attention to what's wrong and what needs to be right. So in the moment, my being an activist for democracy in the United States does sound partisan, but it's not. I will back, I will interview, I will discuss anything with anybody who subscribes to the idea that we live in a democracy in which decisions are made collectively for all of us. Mm-hmm. We're close to not having that. And that's what I need people to understand. Democracies don't disappear through revolution in most cases. They're mostly given away. It's being given away in India right now. It's being given away in Hungary. It's being given away in Turkey. It was never in Russia to start with. But that's what happens because times seem really tough. You get leaders who say, I can fix it for you. They identify who the other is for you. And it feels really comfortable to just sit in that chair and say, yeah, I'm going to let them handle it. We're not letting anybody handle this. We're handling this. That's what I'm an activist for. Mm-hmm. Just that we have agency. We have responsibility. Your citizenship comes with responsibilities to maintain democracy. That's it. That's not wildly partisan. That could be Republican. That could be Democratic in normal times.
You know? So you're kind of glad you got shot with that rubber bullet.
I'm gonna find that guy. I'm gonna figure out who shot. It's 2024. There's some picture of him somewhere. There's
yeah.
some drone footage. And I will thank him. He woke me up. He made me realize we cannot afford to think we live in privilege in this society. While there are some of us who are still without, while there are some of us who don't enjoy full freedoms, and that is a true fact today, it's our fight.
Before we get you out of here, you do mention in this book your time working for Al Jazeera America.
Yep.
Recent news that Al Jazeera will be shuttered in Israel.
Yep.
Can you talk about your experiences working for Al Jazeera America,
yep.
granted,
yep.
different wing
yep.
of the organization, and the type of reporting you did and what you think of that decision?
Well, I'll give you an example. I was 12 or 13 years at CNN. I think I got one Emmy nomination, 2 years at Al Jazeera, and I got three. It is a serious, serious news organization. It has its biases. There's no question. Media organizations have their biases. It is run by a country that is not democratic, but a lot of Arab countries don't like Al Jazeera because they go and foment this groundswell movement in these other countries, mm-hmm. and they don't like it. So if you remember, the boycott of Qatar by Saudi Arabia, demand number one was shut down Al Jazeera. So Al Jazeera is all about people wanting to shut them down. I will say this. There are a lot of places that Israel can claim it's doing the right thing, and one of them has been, generally speaking, its relative freedom of the press. So I think this was a bad move. I think this is a capitulation to the right wing in Israel that's not going to help the situation that's underway right now.
And you felt free to do independent, rigorous journalism when you worked
100%.
Yeah.
Rule with Al Jazeera was that you don't have my phone number. Don't call me. I won't call you. And they lived by that for the 3 years that I worked with them.
Wow. As we wrap up, we have less than a minute, but what do you think is our role, should be our role? We have this big election coming up.
Yep.
As journalists, what do you think?
Bear witness. Tell people what's going on out there and try and ask the important questions. That's why I go for banned books, because we have to understand where our democracy is being taken away in little bits. Let's make sure our viewers, our listeners and readers understand the little ways in which you may not feel it all that much. Just may make you feel a little uncomfortable, but it's actually the erosion of democracy.
And this book we're talking about today is about little bits of courage that got you to where you are today. It's called Small Acts of Courage. It's by Ali Velshi, just out. And you can see Ali tonight for his book launch at the Fittler Club Room, 1 South 24th Street in Philadelphia at 6 p.m. Ali Velshi, thank you so much for the time today.
My pleasure.
And I'm out for the rest of the week.
All
we'll
right.
leave the show in capable hands. And that is our show for today. Our producers, thank you to Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez is our engineer from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolf-Manirin. I feel a little sad that I'm not going to see you tomorrow, Cherry.
But
you'll be back.
Next week.
You'll be back. We'll see you then.